I want to do biblical studies and I want to talk about doing biblical studies. There's a wide range of background here, and I'd like to make some comments on what I'm about in terms of comments about interpretation and methods of interpretation. And those of you who are interested in theory, hermeneutics, can pick up on some of those kinds of questions. I would also like to do biblical studies, some general historical materials, but in particular some particular texts, so that we work together on representing texts, so that in a way it's tell and show, it's comment and demonstration. And I hope that the three sessions will raise some issues for you and generate some conversation for you and some ideas for your further study this year. I want to do at least two of the 3 weeks on Isaiah of Jerusalem, because he is so pivotal and formative for Hebrew tradition. And if it works, we'll do the third session on 2nd Isaiah, which is another prophet from the exilic period and is famous for the suffering servant passage, really comes out of 2nd Isaiah. But I don't think you'll see the force of the suffering servant passage unless you know something of the previous preoccupations of the prophets. So much for overview. Comment on books in the library. There's a little book by Walter Brueggemann, which is both in the library and isn't it in the bookstore, Mary? I think it may be in the bookstore. It's called The Prophetic Imagination, which is fun and helpful. The most solid and germinative book that I see in the library is Von Rott, The Message of the Prophets. And there are two copies in the library, and there are two copies in the bookstore. And those of you who want to pursue the study of the prophets might want to buy that one. There's also a lot of junk in the library. Like every library I've ever been in, there is compostable and combustible, and they haven't, the garbologist has not been through the library lately, so anybody caught with Haley's Bible Handbook, for example, should be sent to the tailings and such things. Okay, Haley's was respectable in about 1850, but not anymore. Which leads me to my comment that I don't know what's... there is a moral dimension to biblical studies. I think the most important moral dimension is honesty. And there is a lot of coyness with the Bible. And I think we have come to the place in the history of our piety where we need to speak honestly and plainly with one another about how the Bible helps us and how it does not. There are several ways of stating the goals of interpretation. The fancy word for interpretation is hermeneutics. The plain word is interpretation. The simple way to say it in Anglo-Saxon, if you really want to say it in plain English, it's how to read a text. One very profound way of stating the goal of interpretation is Paul Ricoeur's suggestion that interpretation is the movement from innocence to naivete. It's the movement from innocence to naivete. It's the movement from the person who is not aware of the complexity, through the complexity, through the alienation to the original innocence, and on to a second innocence, a situation in which you integrate and subordinate your awareness to the power and force of the text itself, which one can talk about as reaching a state of naivete, where you can read and hear the text fully, but not in the same way, not in quite the same way as you heard it in the originally. There are some people who must move from innocence to naivete because they have left the Garden of Eden. It is not a moral obligation for all people to move from innocence to naivete. One of the great imponderables and mysteries about the life of the church is that there are always innocents who there are some innocents who understand the Bible better than some literates. And so we are constantly reminded of the humanness of interpretation by the great innocents. But most of us in this society cannot avoid moving from innocence to naivete. If we try to hang on to our innocence when we have left innocence, we get into an enormous number of more confusion than we need, and so forth. Innocence to naivete. Another way to put the goal of interpretation is to say that the goal of interpretation is to hear the meaning which created the text, or hear the meaning which respects the text, or simply hears the text. A text, words on a piece of paper are like numbers in a computer. A text is, after all, a human device for the storage of meaning, and is not the meaning that is not the way meaning happens or the way meaning is internalized. So meaning precedes the text and meaning follows the text. And the goal of interpretation is in some sense to enable us to hear the meaning by means of the text or with the text. We can talk more about this later on. Some concerns I have for hermeneutics. I am, like Larry, concerned not to be reductionist, not to say that there's only one way that is the right way and that everybody ought to do it. The way I want to state that concern is in different language from Larry, in that I would say I have a concern for pluralism. I think it's just great to read the Bible devotionally, to use the Bible as a script to open us up to what God is doing in our lives. I think that is nurturing. I think that is positive, and if there is no moral abuse of other people, it is a good use of the Bible. I don't want to... My advocacy of critical study of the Bible is not meant to imply that this is the only way to study the Bible, or that the devotional use of the Bible is not helpful, or the theological use of the Bible is not helpful, or the liturgical use of the Bible is not helpful. It's simply, I am for pluralism. And it does seem to me that one of the really crucial things for us in our world today, and not just as Christians, is to learn to live affirmingly and comfortably with doing our own thing and affirming other people's doing something different. So that I am very interested in pluralism, and I am I think it's my strategy is somewhat different than Larry's. Instead of trying to pull, to highlight the themes that run through everything, I am more interested in delimiting one way of going about things and suggesting that this is one among several. It's not the only way to do it, but just to show what happens when you do it this way and what this way of doing things is good for, so that you will discover both the uses and the limits of this way of doing things. One of the ways to, in some ways, until you have pushed a discipline to its limits, you don't know that discipline. Every discipline is a tool, and you can do some things with it and not other things. Okay, so I'm concerned then, as I was saying before, in chocolate bar Bible study. In other words, I'm concerned with the kind of Bible study that has as its concern the representing, the exploring of the Bible itself as kind of an end in itself. I assume that it's fun and sometimes helpful and sometimes upsetting to have the Bible around the church. And it's really important to let the shape, form, structure, potentiality of the text be explored just for its own sake. It opens up possibilities for people that want to use the Bible, but it doesn't exactly tell you what you have to do with it. You may just like to look at it. And that's okay. That's okay. It's great to look at mountains, and it's great to look at the Bible. It's a beautiful book. And it's a good book. In a way, critical study is looking for classic interpretation, is questing for the times and the places where a major piece of the Bible seemed to wed itself with some kind of cultural crisis or issue. I think the Bible came out, the text that we have in the Bible came out of those kinds of situations, and it's very exciting when those happen. I think, for example, one of the most immediate is the way in which the Exodus stories and the Bible has fertilized black experience in America. If any of you are interested, read What's Your Cone Book?
God of the Oppressed.
And the one I like very much is The Spirituals and the Blues, which is a wonderful introduction to the Bible and shows how they leavened and helped to sustain black experience in America. I think Luther, for example, and his rediscovery of the meaning of Paul for the 16th century is another great breakthrough. I think Barth's second edition of Romer Brief, commentary on Romans, which was one of the great, this sort of signaled the beginning of the neo-Orthodox protest to the insipid state of 19th century liberalism. So every now and then there are great interpretive movements and judgments that flow out of this, although it would be nice if they had happened more often, and so on. My third concern is for images, for voicing, for stories, for form, for the concrete ways in which humans experience this kind of text. Now, first, so much for the concerns, let me begin with a hermeneutical thesis or something like this. And this is a kind of, it's a riddle. It's not a metaphor, it's a riddle. A text is a text is a text is a text. There is something very concrete about a text. It is not a theme in experience. It is something that I can touch, that has continuity. The day that oral tradition was able to be incarnated in, with some kind of fixity in script, in scroll, gave an enormous amount of continuity and permanence to past meanings, and preserved past experiences in a way that has made them accessible to successive generations. Before text, in the oral tradition period, what I have depends on the memory of my parents. So that it's a fairly conservative process. I have no way of critically evaluating the tradition. Once there is a text, I can read the text as well as my parents can read the text. And so a text becomes both a powerful platform, a powerful way of conserving meaning, and at the same time opens up the possibility of reformation and radical interpretations, because in fact I discover that my parents were telling me things that were not the case, and there's a different way to read it. There's a different way to read it without being disloyal to the train of ancestry. And so the Bible has both been an ingredient in continuity, and it has been the sustainer of radical reformations through the history of the Christian community. It's also worth noting that the Jewish community and the Islamic community, the other religions of the book, have had also an enormous ability to maintain continuity and to foster various kinds of new movements. And when you think of how long particular nations have existed, how long particular companies have existed, the achievement of some sense of serious continuity that goes from first 1000 BC to nearly 2000 AD is a fairly strong sense of community. So a text is a text is a text. It's a concrete carrier of meaning. It enables continuity, and it enables reinterpretation. Now, from that, a corollary of that is that if a text is a text is a text, the interpretation which opens up more of the text is better than the interpretation which opens up less of the text. So that the struggle of interpretation is always to encompass another aspect of the text that maybe your predecessor did not see. And so there is a goal of inclusiveness to include the whole text. So, for example, most of the biblical theology movement attended to what the words of the text said. Since that time, many of us have become more interested in what the text did, in the form of the text, in the action of the text. Not simply in a gospel lesson, not simply what did Jesus say, but what did Jesus say when he did that. For example, in the sixth chapter of the Gospel of John, they came to make him king and he walked away. So in effect, the text says, I'm not with all those people who want Jesus just for miracles, and if you try to make Jesus king because he does miracles, he won't stick around. He won't stick around. The words of the text and the action of the text. And today the text I've chosen is one whose form is particularly rich, and you'll see how essential it is, how important it is to deal with that. So the whole text. Just again a footnote to this, or a corollary of this, be alerted to how many Christians want to peel off the text and get the theology. We have orange juice Christians or lemon juice Christians. They don't like the lemons, they like the lemon juice. They don't like the oranges, they like the orange juice. Well, if you had only orange juice, you would have no idea of what oranges are. It's perfectly all right to make orange juice. But orange juice is not oranges. It just happens to be the part of the oranges we like, most of you like. I happen to like orange peel, so I really like the whole orange and not just the orange juice. But a text is a sensual, has meaning is carried by something quasi-physical, something sensual, something concrete, and it is not just the theology. It works sometimes. I mean, you take the peas out of the pea pod, you can have green peas. But try taking the seed out of the peach, you won't have much. Or the seeds out of the apple, something like that. So a text is a text is a text means that if the author of Job had wanted to tell you the theology in straight prose form, he might have. If he chose to write a lyric imaginative poem, then what he was saying is, what I want to say is best said this way. So a parable of Jesus is a parable of Jesus is a parable of Jesus, and the whole point is that Jesus wanted to do stories rather than theology. So if you make a parable into theology, you are using it in a way that is legitimate for the church to use it, but you are moving away in that instant from the text and from the way in which this particular piece of meaning is carried. So in a way, the goal of interpretation is to be able to simply read the text and have people hear it and enjoy it. It would be fun, you know. Every once in a while, I would read the text at the end of the sermon rather than at the beginning of the sermon, because the point of the sermon was to help people be able to hear the text, and rather than to... You know, there's another kind of sermon which I think is a good sermon, to pay your dues to the text and then reflect on the life of the community, and that needs to be done. Again, I'm pluralistic. But there's another kind of sermon too. All right. That's sort of the end of my comments on hermeneutics. Any questions? All right, bump into me. Form. That's important for this text. Quickly, the Bible is not a history book. The Bible is an anthology. The Hebrew Scriptures is an anthology of the literature of Israel, and it includes hymns, it includes laws, it includes sermon stuff, it includes narrative, it includes proverbs. It includes a few short stories. It just includes all the best literature that they had. And so to hear these texts, it's very important to know the form and perhaps also to know something of the time in the sequence of the history of Israel. And I want to today spend some time on the most dramatic of the forms. Now the form what we're doing is Isaiah, and the form we're doing is a little dramatic poem in Isaiah. And you need to know something. I need to refresh your memory about prophecy and prophets. And for Rick, you need very quickly to review the history of Israel. Basically, Israel is 1,000 years B.C. What happened to a people in the first millennium BC. Now, the first civilizations in India and Mesopotamia are about 4,000 BC. So these people are 2,000 or 3,000 years into human civilization. They do not regard themselves as Hicks. But the people in Palestine are a little bit out in the country. They're not from New York, they're from North Dakota. And so they tend to be somewhat impressed by what goes on in Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia, for for the non-map people is Iraq. Persia is Iran. Got it? Iran is Persia, Mesopotamia is Iraq, and Israel is Israel and Lebanon and that turf there. And it's in this kind of geographic area that we're dealing with. And the history of Israel happened largely in this little country under the Assyrians, then the Neo-Babylonians, then the Medes and the Persians, then the Greeks, Alexander and so forth, then the Romans. So you have a little country like Yugoslavia or Finland or Lithuania which lived its experience under three or four of the major world powers of the time. So it's this little crucible of a country which works out its own insights and meanings within the kind of hustle and bustle of the ancient power struggles. Now, one thing that you really need to know about geography. Here we are. Here's Egypt, all right? Here's Iraq over here, and here's Palestine. Nowadays you just hop like that. In those days you didn't. There's a lot of desert in there, and that's hard to travel. So you go this way. Now if this is a world power, and this is a world power, one of the nice places to have your war so you don't kill too many, you know, you don't burn up the Egyptian crops, and you don't burn up the Iraqi crops, is to have them in Palestine. Because that's on the way between these two. So the politics of this is that Palestine is forever jockeying back and forth between the politics of Egypt and the politics of Assyria. And in fact, what's going on in the time of Isaiah, which is right around here, and if you look on this sheet, you'll see the first Isaiah 1 through 39, you'll see the oracle sketched 740 to 732, 732 to 721, etc., etc. What's going on about that time is one of the things that happens is Assyria keeps coming to the borders and threatening Jerusalem, and at one point, later than this particular oracle, even Israel, the northern kingdom, comes and okay, again, back to the history. World powers, Assyria, Neo-Babylonia, Medes and Persians, Greeks, Romans. The kingdom, the nation is really organized. I'll be willing to talk about it, but I think you have a bunch of stories from what happens before 1000, but it's not possible to construct much of the history. The nation is really organized with David around the year 1000. And because there's a kind of lull in world politics, somebody's having trouble at home, David gets to build a big kingdom. The Davidic nation lasts about 100 years. By 922, Solomon has spent the Davidic capital and the kingdom breaks into two parts. Breaks back into the two tribal leagues, one the 10-tribe league and one the 2-tribe league, the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom. By 722, the northern kingdom has had it and is captured by Assyria. The great prophets of that period are Amos and Hosea. At the same time that the northern kingdom is deteriorating and Amos and Hosea are preaching, you have Isaiah in Jerusalem preaching. And Micah, Isaiah's the city folk and Micah's the rural folk. And so Isaiah talks about a Davidic king and Micah talks about Bethlehem, the Messiah coming from Bethlehem, etc. So you have this. Now the Davidic kingdom lasted down till 585. Then that is smashed and you have exile. 530, you have them come back and rebuild, and then there are a succession of a more complex history, which I'll do later if any of you want it. Okay. Now, pre-David, in the old stories of the judges, you will remember how these judges, there wasn't a national government. There were these sort of charismatic types who in wartime could put it together. You'll notice there were both men and women. There was Deborah as well as Barak. There's a wonderful song about a woman military hero as well as other things. It was a somewhat more egalitarian period than the later monarchy. It's still patriarchal, but there are degrees of patriarchy. In this period, the judge was both oracular leader and sometimes military leader. When the monarchy started, the kings never mustered. They were the Supreme Court. David could decide the cases about the poor and so forth. But the kings were never sustained the sort of prophetic voice, those confronting oracles which challenged political power. And so you had off and on particular preachers and spokespersons, sometimes demonstrators, who challenged the public consciousness. And we talk about these as the prophets, and over a period of mid-800s down to about 450, you have about a dozen of them whose sermons were good enough to save. Now that's not a lot for that length of time. So don't be surprised if you aspire to be a prophet and everybody doesn't save your writings. They did a lot of sifting before they put this book together, and they could have, sometimes some of us think they could have done a little more sifting either, but it's at any rate. So notice two things. The Elisha, you have wonderful stories. You have stories like Balaam's ass. That's old cryptic types. Then you have good demonstrators like Elisha and Elijah who put on a scene and really stirred up the public and that sort of thing. But the prophets that we have the biggest group in our Bible are the writing prophets. All of a sudden, with Amos and Hosea, people got more interested in what the prophets said than what they did. And we start having collections of prophetic poem, of prophetic preaching, most of which is poetry. In those days, if you wanted people to think you were inspired, you wrote beautiful sermons. Not just confronting sermons, they were more effective and they were more inspired if they had form and could be remembered and could be sung and could be repeated. This has something to do with the orality of the culture and that sort of thing. So now sometimes there are stories about the prophets. There's hardly any stories about Isaiah except a few little references to him being upper crust and in the palace in Jerusalem, and he's clearly a royalist and that sort of thing. The one prophet that there are really stories about as well as sermons from is Jeremiah. But by and large, don't regard Jonah really as a prophet. Jonah's really a short story from the Hellenistic period. Okay, so you have then a prophetic movement which had a pre-literary history and then an enormous collection, and you can group the prophets. In Hebrew, there's Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and the Book of the Twelve, which is all the little ones. You know, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah. Don't you know those? Didn't you go to Sunday school? My goodness gracious, come on. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Oh, goodness. How will you ever have enough names for your male children without knowing the minor? Anyhow, in Hebrew they didn't call them the minor prophets because some of them are pretty major, although they're small books. They called them the Book of the Twelve. At any rate, you have a little cluster of prophets right around the 8th century when Samaria falls. Hosea, Joel, Isaiah, Micah. You have another cluster of fairly important ones around the time that Jerusalem falls. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then during the exile, second Isaiah, and then you have another cluster in the post-exilic period, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. And so there are three fairly defined clusters of prophets that are connected with fairly turbulent crisis periods in the life of the people, rather like I think Neo-Orthodoxy is connected with the period of the two wars. And I wonder sometimes whether there is great, really monumental preaching and theology without monumental disaster. But, you've gotten some sense of when the prophets happen. Notice that I've tried to de-emphasize their clairvoyance. Some of them had visions. Most of the time you can make perfectly good sense of the prophets in terms of their own time. You don't have to talk about the prophets as foreseeing the time of Christ or foreseeing 50 years ahead or something like that. If any of you want to talk about that kind of apologetics, I think it's not very helpful nowadays, but what is helpful is to look at the prophets as preachers, but preachers who have a strong sense of being sent, of speaking on behalf of the Lord, of being willing even to speak with the Lord's voice, and not afraid to find in their message the Word of God, so that there is a willingness to be authoritative about these figures that may not be possible in the modern world, but was very important for the shape of the prophets. Okay, just to recap, Isaiah, southern kingdom, Judah, Jerusalem, big main city, court, that's where the king, that's where the temple is, and Isaiah believes in all of that. He is not a marginal prophet, he's an establishment prophet. A word about Hebrew ways of thinking about God. How did the Hebrews know that God was their God? They knew because they had been liberated from slavery. They knew because they had the land. They knew because their kingdom prospered. The normal way of people knowing that God is God is because of the prospering of their life. And if you look at Islamic history and if you look at Christian history, a prevailing sense of providence dominates many of the pages in the history. It's not mystical experience as much as it is practical social experience. Why do Americans feel confident that about their situation? They think, a lot of them think in some sense, look what God has done for us, therefore it must be good, therefore we must be on the right track. Okay, now notice, on the one hand, what a clear, simple way, sort of pragmatic way of perceiving God that is, that sort of encompasses everybody whether they are pious or not. Notice, on the other hand, the major vulnerability of that kind of religious experience and theology. What do you do when things don't go well? What do you do when you begin to think that you're so special that nothing, that God will always take care of you? And so this Deuteronomic sense of prosperity is fairly important as part of the religious background. of this text and so on. This text comes from 740 to 730. Enough about Isaiah. Any comments about Isaiah or questions? Is there something I should have said about Isaiah that I didn't? Remember, the book that we call Isaiah is an anthology with Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah, and 3rd Isaiah collection. Okay? This text I chose because it is a strong illustration of form, of the importance of form in relationship to understanding texts. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. What's the form? Huh? Right, and why not just call it a love song, probably? Probably Feast of Tabernacles, probably. It sounds very much like a ballad. So in general, at least part of the text is a ballad. There is a section that interprets the ballad at the end that is not part of the ballad. Let me sing for my beloved. Who's speaking? Just footnote. The Hebrew texts have no punctuation, all right? Just like Greek texts of Greek drama, they have no punctuation. They put in the words, or in fact in Hebrew they didn't even put in the vowels, they just put in the consonants, but they did not separate between the words, and they did not have quotation marks. So the most perplexing thing with this stuff is to find out where the quotation marks would have been if somebody had had quotation marks, and where the voicing would have been if somebody had set it out dramatically and said first voice, second voice, third voice. All right, who's speaking in one? Let me sing for my beloved. How shall we characterize the voice?
Female.
What?
Female voice.
Could be a female voice, or it could be a male voice. In there, Jonathan loved David, and David loved his wives, and so there was all kinds of loving relationships in Israel. It is a friend or lover relationship. Let me sing for my beloved a love song about his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. Vineyard, vineyard, vineyard. Why is vine important? What's with vineyard? Christ is considerably later, so that they would not have known anything about Christ. Why would vine have been important to them? They've got a lot of vineyards. This is Napa Valley. Napa Valley, Middle East. So it's vine country. Anything else? What? It's a very important growth analogy.
It produces one of their staples. It's one of the basic things that they consume.
And there's something rather universal about, almost universal about wine. It's wine generally, although it has had ill effects. Wine generally has been a happy thing in many cultures that have not abused it. Remember that the old struggle between Elijah and the Baal was a struggle between historical religion and fertility cults. And one of the things that happens in the 8th century is that you have the prophets daring to use the imagery of their opponents and twist it around. So Hosea takes love imagery and subordinates it to covenant theology, and you vine are perfectly good fertility symbols, which Isaiah is using in a new context rather than simply a naturalistic fertility. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes. What's the picture? What's the mood? What do you get out of that story about the beloved? What's the beloved's relationship to the vineyard?
Tender care.
Work, care. Well, how else does the beloved look at the vineyard?
Expectation.
Expectation. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. He's done all his work. There's certainly going to be a good crop. Get the wine vat ready. Get it all set for the harvest. Lots of expectations. Did everything that you... I mean, he was a... Did all that an agronomy type in that culture could do for the thing, for the vineyard. Now, the next line is enormously dramatic and just change. Here you have this lovely, melodious love song, but it yielded wild grapes. But it yielded wild grapes. Grapes that aren't usable for wine. Grapes that would have been on the wild vines and left just in the field or left for the animals. But it yielded wild grapes. So the first stanza sets up the picture of the enormous care and the disappointment, the change, the problem. Second stanza. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What voice is there in this stanza? The owner of the vineyard is speaking. Notice that we have... How do you know that? What are the words that tell you?
Judge between me and my vineyard.
Okay, the pronoun has shifted. And so instead of speaking in the third person, it's really like another scene in a play. And you have another voice, which is now talking. Now, who is he addressing? What's going on here? Okay, now what is their way of doing, settling disputes? I mean, they don't have an elaborate 3-4 sets of appeal courts and this sort of thing. How would you settle a dispute?
You bring in a certain amount of witnesses.
You go down to coffee time and you stand there and talk to all the old men and tell them the way you see it and see if they contradict you. So that you have this street justice going on, this village kind of justice, which is not organized, but really quite. If you want an survival of this, see the survival of this kind of justice. It actually works, as a matter of fact. I think it's a little unsettling for us highly tech organized moderns, but you see something of this in some tribal communities. You also see something of this in Iran. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? What's the tone of that line? Complaint? I'd like to stall the judgment. You'll hear the judgment more clearly in the next stanza.
Oh, another exasperation.
Exasperation, despair. What else could I have done? Is there anything that I could have done for the vineyard that I didn't do? In other words, an opening up of the responsibility of the owner. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it when I looked for it to yield grapes? Why did it yield wild grapes? What's the tone of that line? Very, very deep, almost like the why you ask when somebody dies, which is a why and it isn't a why. You know, a very strong, expressive why. Any of you hear anything else in that way? I think the focus, notice that when I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? Notice the grapes is repeated twice and the eye once. So that the focus is not on why me, but why wild grapes? Why wild grapes? How could this have happened, kind of? How could it have gone wrong? Or something like that. All right, next stanza. And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. What's the difference between the second stanza and the third stanza? What is happening in the second stanza, and how has the action shifted in scene three? First, in stanza two, he's playing the defendant and pleading the case. In stanza three, he's testing out the judgment. He's provoked. And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste, and it shall not be pruned or hoed. And briars and thorns will grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. What is the picture of what is the person going to do? What kind of action is the person taking?
Revenge, destruction, and anger.
Point up the picture more clearly. Yes, there's. It is certainly an act of decision and judgment. It could be anger, but not capricious anger, certainly. What actively is in the picture? What is the person actually doing? What kind of punishment?
Well, he's removing protection.
He's walking away. He's abandoning the vineyard. And you have an actual reversal of the paradise image. Instead, after all this care, there's nothing else to do but walk away and maybe try again someplace else.
Not quite as simple, because he also says, I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. I mean, so walking away, but also saying, you're really going to get it.
Yeah, that's a very curious line. I think that is a little bit of a clue of the transition to the next part, and is a very, he's going to break down the hedge, so it's a fairly active walking away. I mean, he's going to leave the door open and walk away.
It's more than walking away, in the sense that I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed. And it's not just leaving it behind and see what happens to it.
Mm-hmm. Almost putting a curse on it.
Yeah, it is a kind of curse, but would you note that it is much more passive image than this picture of God? It's a very different image than the soldier setting fire to the field. It's a very different image.
No, it isn't. I will remove its head.
In other words, you're not going to protect it.
Yeah, so that it will be devoured. That's why I want to remove it.
And other people will devour it. The animals will devour it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled on. And I will not prune it or hoe it. And so what will happen? The briars and the thorns, which are in the soil. And I mean, it's very much like letting the weeds, that parable of the tares and the wheat, where you let them grow together. And there is a natural
So he's saying that he's not taking the action himself. It's almost a prediction or a prophecy.
He's opening the door for the return to wilderness.
Yeah.
So much the picture, so much the picture, so much the ballad, so much the love song. And it seems to me in the next verse you have the prophet's voice, which then interprets the song. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold a cry. How much of the previous poem does that explain? Well, one more thing. Would you notice pleasant planting? Notice a little play here. It's a beautiful, it's poetically very beautiful. What is the relationship of justice and bloodshed? No, they are opposites, but they're also something else besides being opposites.
There's grapes and wild grapes. I don't know if it's stretching it too far, but he looked for, you know, he looked for it to yield grapes and yield wild grapes. In the Lord, but for justice, for people found bloodshed.
All right. What's the opposite of justice? If the simple opposite of justice would be he found
injustice.
Now, what is the relationship of bloodshed to injustice?
It's a result of injustice.
It's an example. It's a concrete example. He looked for justice, the sort of vague thing. He found blood in the street. He looked for righteousness. He heard crying and shouting in the streets. So notice how those two last words, like wild grapes, are very strong and very concrete and very vivid and paint a picture.
It follows a lot of the parable pretty closely in that the bloodshed is one of the fruits of injustice, and the wild grapes and the grapes are what situation yields when you care for it, either correctly or incorrectly.
One word is walk away from the vineyard.
But what has he actually said about God in that verse? That's parallel to the first stanza. God is, God is like the owner.
He's expecting something.
And it didn't, and he found the opposite. He found bloodshed and shouting screams, just like the owner found wild grapes. So what's the tone? What mood is God in? No, just to
the owner of the vineyard.
Which is what?
Disappointed.
Despair, disappointment, if you like. I like Heschel's term pathos. So the poem really ends with the portrait or the sketch of God in a kind of anguish and despair over no fruit coming from all his work. So that there's a kind of picture of despair and anguish and pain and a real picture of, if I may say so, the limits of God. The limits of God. What possible implication might there be from the poem? If you heard this, what would you go on and think?
That God doesn't have the ability to make that kind of grapes.
I think the whole second stanza is that God did everything that he could do to make good grapes.
That's what I'm saying. He did everything he could, but he didn't come up with good grapes.
Uh-huh. So God is in despair. So what might God do?
Leave us and then see what may happen. Taken over by nature.
Notice that the interpretation interprets the first stanza of the poem, but it would be almost inevitable, I think, that those of us who hear that poem go on and speculate about whether God might not therefore abandon or walk away from. All the interpretation says, God's in the depths over the bloodshed and the cry. In other words, what I want you to notice is that there is that the poem starts a train of thinking and a train of imagination which is not stated but is left to the community to think about.
I was going to say whether the poem was self-contained or not originally is now followed by the woe text, the woe passages, which fit very much into the kind of expectation you might see, especially you know, the next one talks about surely many houses shall be desolate, large beautiful houses. The same also idea of moving out and just letting chaos enter in. And it's woe to you who do this, woe to you who do this. It's in the present text, it's almost an explanation of what we expect to follow to look at those second and third stanzas.
I think that's clear that is the way in which they were heard and the way, and that's why it would be put there, because that's why it would have been heard that way. I think that in the original presentation, the something of the shock and something of the uncertainty would have probably been more uncertainty in the I will end in a minute by reading. What kind of issues does this text raise? From my perspective, biblical texts start dialogue. They don't provide you with final answers, but they start conversations on reflection and clarification. And there are several things about this text that it seems to me might be important for us. What strikes you about this text and our situation? What is difficult for us about this text? Where is this text distant from us? Predominant mood of our faith is unquestioned, unflinching affirmation and care, God as the symbol of sunny days and growing fields, and there is very little in our faith and in our religious experience about pain on God's part, what would have in the old days been talked about as the wrath of God. I'm not sure that that's fully the case in this text, but you hear a great deal of talk about the love of God, and can there be love without wrath?
The whole idea of abandonment, I think, is hard for us to conceive of, that God would abandon you even at times when he's despairing.
I think that is one of the that image has become more and more powerful for me, at least, this whole notion of abandonment. And it has, when I put that together with the psalm that is attributed to Jesus on the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? You have here clearly as part of the mood, let me say this again, I want you to hear me. You have here, as part of the repertoire of faith, the experience of being abandoned by God, or the image of the possible abandonment by God. Let me say that again. You have, as part of the repertoire of faith, not unfaith, but as part of the repertoire of faith, the experience of abandonment, or the anticipation of abandonment. I suppose the implications over against the American situation, you know, are fairly obvious. This was clearly in Israel a part of a way of trying to raise Israel's consciousness to precipitate moral reform and foreign policy reform and such things. And reflects a clear theological perception of the freedom of God to both bind and to loose. Other comments on the text?
The idea of limitation, that somehow God won't perform her hocus pocus and make us respond, you know, pull us back from the brink of nuclear war or whatever it is that we dread in our time as a desolation, but that is not the way the relationship is. That it's said here, everything, I have done everything. And so it belies the notions of omnipotent, omniscient, you know, the powerful laboratory that we like to comfort ourselves with, that God ever moves a lot.
Another way in which that same idea could be put is to say that the Israelites took very seriously what happened. In other words, if they were freed from Egypt, then there was some purpose in it, and if they were destroyed, there was some meaning in it. So that they are reflecting, they are pulling together their theological tradition of covenant and reflecting on what actually happens in their own history in the light of this. And as a matter of fact, the Davidic dynasty was destroyed. In 585, there were some feeble attempts to reconstruct it. After the exile, it was not successfully reconstructed until the Hasmonean period, and a good number of the Hasmoneans were sellouts to the world powers, and so that this is one of the texts. This is one of the texts that has been more concretely fulfilled than completed than other Isaiah texts.
Would you say that understanding of being abandoned as a part of the faith experience relates back to how they knew themselves to be people of God, so that if they had no land and they had no protection or no rescue in their immediate experience, and that was their experience of abandonment rather than God in some actual sense walking away and saying, I don't care, and I'm going to let you be destroyed. In the rest of the context of Scripture, it seems hard to say that the complete abandonment is the underlying truth of that passage. And also in light of the other traditions, religious traditions that would have fed into that, different gods of nature had limitations because they were gods of specific things. Gods of weather, gods of this, gods of fertility. And their concept of God was that. I mean, do you think that filtered into that?
Yeah, it's not, it's in the overall story, it's not total abandonment in the context of the monarchy and the land. There is some real actualization of this theme. And yes, you're right that this is the meaning that Israel had because it understood itself as having been created providentially and been given the land. So that Israel had a special dialogue with God that was the meaning of its existence and would not necessarily be the way in which another people would conceive of their experience. But it was the way in which Israel understood itself.
So really there should be some clarification then between how, what that sort of abandonment meant for those people and in this sort of situation than to how we would understand being abandoned by God. What would you say?
Be careful. If you are doing a systematic view of God, you can set up a number of paradigm options. But in fact, we in our experience are not, we dare not lean on the universals because we may blind ourselves to the particulars. The force of this text is that God may choose, God did choose, God was in anguish and could walk away from Israel. And we know from further historical events that in some sense he did walk away from the nation of Israel.
Only if you understand that the recognition of God not walking away as being having land and having prosperity, right?
Say that again.
I mean, the only way you know that God had walked away was the lack of those things that you identified with the presence of God.
Yes, yes, yes. This is this. But if this text, it seems to me this text does raise the possibility in our present for those who conceive of land and corporate communal life as some concrete covenant that God is not a function of covenant, but is a covenanter. And is not a cipher of a covenant that we break, whether it be the American nation or whether it be the Christian church. It seems to me a text like this poses the possibility that we ought not to view God as a function of an idea, but that there is that there is a kind God as Isaiah knew him was a God who felt free to walk away from a broken covenant. He didn't waste his time on wild grape vines, and he may not, or she may not, choose to waste her time on America or the Christian church. They don't produce more than wild grapes.
Can I ask in follow-up how tight the understanding of cause-effect relationship is in the text for God's walking away? Did Israel understand, for he looked for justice, but behold bloodshed, for righteousness, for behold a cry? Is that the reason for walking away? Is it because of injustice? Is there a tight understanding of the fact that this essentially moral transgression or failure on Israel's part communicate to.
And it's because God has, in this story, God has done all he can do.
Yeah.
Or will,
mm-hmm.
all he can do.
Mm-hmm.
And the next move is to have people deal with the results of irresponsibility.
Do you think that that would be different if it were the same sort of meaning trying to be portrayed from someone that wasn't Isaiah, it was as it was the marginal prophet instead of someone who was kingly and priestly and had that sense of power of, I don't have to waste my time with you if you're not going to produce what I want? I mean,
in
that
this,
to me more like...
In this century, you have a similar pessimism in Amos, not quite as pessimistic, but still an expectation of disaster in Hosea. By the 5th century, when in fact the worst of the disasters hit, then you begin to have prophets who change their notes.
Is that impending doom similar to the idea, or is it the same idea that God has turned his back, kind of?
No, in some cases it's a much more active sense. They don't have a picture of a field going backwards, they have a picture of an army devastating, and God as a warrior god is personified in the enemy army that devastates the... one of the most beautiful things is in Amos, fallen no more to rise is the virgin Israel, forsaken on her land with none to raise her up, and you have this marvelous, just absolutely stunning picture of a raped or killed woman laying on the burnt, probably burnt land, which is the sign that the army had come through. And you have the devastation in just almost like Hiroshima pictures in that one.
So one of the things that makes this difficult for me is that, especially in our culture, we view ourselves primarily as individuals, not as a nation, not as a corporate body. And this seems to be directed toward a corporate sense of Israel. So it doesn't matter if there are even righteous or just a few righteous people, whatever, God is dealing with this group of people called Israel in totality, and we apply that to us, and we say, well, I'm righteous within this whole culture, but God deals with us as a corporate body too. Or is it different now? You try to view it as, well, traditionally it's different now, but is it?
You put your finger on a very, very important issue, an enormously important issue. You will find one or two places in the Hebrew Scriptures, a few places where they are more preoccupied with the individual, but the mainline preachers are preoccupied with the nation, not with the individual. And I think this is, in some sense, more true of the New Testament than most of us realize. But I think you have raised a very important issue about modern individualism. Spence was next, I think.
Oh, I agree. I just say that I think sometimes we think we're more individual oriented than we are, and when you see situations like the Iranian crisis or the threat of communism or these things, so much of our culture is quick to rally to a corporate identity. As long as it doesn't seem to be a threat, we like to view ourselves as individuals free to do everything. But I'm always amazed how quickly this country can create new enemies and rally around that.
But the ancient world was not a world where the whole world was populated.
No, I know
the
that.
Ancient world was in community, and they had a clear sense that survival and life and civilization depended on the communities to which they... And they belonged to minority communities. The early Christians were a minority community, and their survival in the Roman Empire depended upon their solidarity. So you find an enormously important concern for the community.